So welcome this afternoon to our session, Crisis Standards of Care. This is really going to be an opportunity for my colleague and I to present on the committee work for the Institute of Medicine Crisis Standards of Care Committee. And what we're going to be doing today is actually tag teaming. We actually, if you looked at your program, and I know all of you did, there were actually three speakers that we had that were supposed to be here, Dr. Powell, myself, as well as Dr. Dan Hanfling. And Dr. Hanfling is actively involved in emergency response in the Washington, D.C. area, actually Northern Virginia. And as I think all of us know, there was a little bit of a storm that apparently was coming up the East Coast. And so very late, we learned that he was unable to travel. So, which again, I think speaks volumes to the fact that not only are we committee members that are really about the theory of emergency response, but really about the practice of. And so we wish, obviously, Dan, as well as all the other folks on the East Coast, well. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and get started. So Dan had the honor of being the moderator, so I'm going to now be the moderator. Tia has decided that she's going to actually give me the 5 or 2 minute mark, so that was good because I thought I was going to actually have to give it to myself, so I thought that was going to be a little bit odd. But what we're going to be doing is talking about crisis standards of care, the IOM report that came out, a letter report that came out in 2009, as well as a follow-up report that came out here in 2012 in March of this year. And then we're going to actually talk a little bit about, we're going to segue into state and local government, the role of government, and then we're going to move into ethics, and really I'm going to turn that over to Dr. Powell, and she's going to be speaking about the ethical component of crisis standards of care planning and response. And then I'll conclude with public engagement, which was a significant part of our work. And we are joined in the audience by Barbara Fain, who is our consultant for the public engagement piece. Barbara, if you can raise your hand, and we're really excited to have her in the audience because actually we think that she's going to have a lot of insights into the public engagement aspect of this. And so, Barbara, if you could certainly help us with some questions and answers, because I'm sure there are going to be some comments that are going to be coming our way. So with that, one last thing is that I'm also supposed to say that this is the session from Injury Control and Emergency Health Services, ICEHS. I'm a section member, and so all of you, if you would like to join a second section, this would be your opportunity to designate us. So now I've done all my plugs. All right. Crisis Standards of Care Systems Framework for Catastrophic Disaster Response. And what I'm going to do is really go through initially Dr. Hanfling's slides. So I think it's appropriate for me to introduce Dr. Hanfling in absentia here. Dr. Hanfling is the vice chair for our IOM committee. He is a special advisor to the Inova Health System in Falls Church, Virginia, on matters related to emergency preparedness and disaster response. He is a board-certified emergency physician practicing at Inova Fairfax Hospital, Northern Virginia's Level 1 Trauma Center. He serves as an operational medical director for PHI Air Medical Group, Virginia, and has responsibilities as the medical team manager for Virginia Task Force 1, an international urban search and rescue team sanctioned by FEMA and USAID. And by the way, they did deploy to Haiti as part of the U.S. response. He has been involved with response to numerous international and domestic disaster events. Dr. Hanfling was integrally involved in the management of the response to the anthrax bioterror mailings when two cases of an inhalational anthrax were successfully diagnosed at Inova Fairfax Hospital. He's clinical professor of emergency medicine at George Washington University, contributing scholar at the UPMC Center for Biosecurity, adjunct faculty of the George Mason University School of Public Policy, Office of International Medical Policy. Dr. Hanfling received an AB in political science from Duke, an MD from Brown. He completed an internship in internal medicine at the Miriam Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, and an emergency medicine residency at George Washington, Georgetown University Hospitals. So I'm going to be Dan. So So just to let you know, I guess it would be appropriate then to introduce myself. My name is Umair Shah. I'm the Deputy Director at Harris County Public Health and Environmental Services down in Houston, Texas. I'm going to do a little shout out. My director, Dr. Palacio, is in the audience as well. If you could just raise your hand. There you go. So I come from a perspective really of a local health department as well as emergency response perspective. I'm going to be doing dance slides, and then I'm going to be segueing into state and local government. So no relationships to disclose, financial or otherwise. I think it would be great if we had some relationships to disclose, but unfortunately we don't have any, so we're going to kind of bore you with the information as we have it. So just a little bit about, first of all, where I come from. Harris County, Texas, third most populous county in the nation with a population of 4+ million. When we do our planning for some of our emergency response efforts, our daytime population in the entire county, including some of the neighboring communities, is 5 to 6 million. We're spread over the size of Rhode Island, and we're quite diverse, both geographically, politically, but also demographically. And HCPHES serves as the county health department for Harris County. So I'll just go through some objectives very quickly. We're going to discuss disaster planning and the role of crisis standards of care. I maybe use the word CSC, so that's what that's referring to in surge response. We'll provide an overview of, as I mentioned, the 2009-2012 reports, talk a little bit about the functions and tasks to guide entities in developing CSC plans, but particularly in the government role. And then Dr. Powell, who I will be introducing, will review ethical considerations in CSC planning, and then we'll articulate the importance and role of public engagement. So first of all, what is a disaster? I think it might be helpful to just have an operational definition. I think all of us know this, but we're really talking about a disaster being a large-scale event or occurrence that completely overwhelms a system's ability to respond. So we're talking about disaster, but we're talking about, in this session, a change of scale that we're really going to be talking about completely overwhelming. And so in some ways, you may be calling it a catastrophic disaster or a crisis. So just think about disaster and kind of a continuum of being one of those where all resources in some way are overwhelmed. Our committee had categorized disasters in two different ways, really catastrophic events, which would be sudden onset, little or no notice, and I think all of us can think of these: acts of intent, mass casualty incidents, earthquakes, tsunamis, etc., or obviously hurricanes. Pervasive events, which are really slow onset with gradual progression, and the examples would be floods, wildfires, and pandemics. And why are these important? Well, on catastrophic, it's like a no-notice, boom, it happens, and your resources are gone, and you need to respond, and it's going to be a while before you can get external help. With pervasive events, as we all know, even when we think about pandemic planning, that you might have resources that are slowly going to be consumed over time, but at the end of the day, you still may not have the resources to be able to manage the response. So again, here's some examples, or at least some sort of visuals of catastrophic type of events. So you can think of really all the different kinds of events, whether they're flood events, or I point to the top right, which is after the Kashmir earthquake, where you could take a butter knife, if you will, and just kind of cut this mountain, and everything that was underneath it just sort of slid onto all the villages, et cetera, underneath, as well as the palace in Port-au-Prince. And so certainly catastrophic events, I think all of us have an idea about what those would be. Pervasive events, again, being the visual of being these either pandemics or these flood type of events or wildfires, where again those resources are going to be slowly over time, whether it's months, whether it's weeks, whether it may be even longer, you have a situation where the resources are going to be taken. So our Institute of Medicine committee, really what we went about doing was to establish guidance for crisis standards of care for use in disaster situations. So that's kind of the big title here. So in a crisis, how do standards of care change so that you can manage the situation? So why? I guess that's the million-dollar question. So we came together, the Institute of Medicine brought us together as an expert committee, really in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And so all of us remember Hurricane Katrina and the resources that were used, but the fact was that there were a lot of response efforts that were happening, and they were happening on the ground, and they were happening on the fly. So there was not a lot of sort of advance, if we're going to triage, if we're going to try to evacuate, if we're going to try to move people out of harm's way, how are we best going to be able to do that? And so the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, the ASPR, asked the Institute of Medicine to convene a group to really think about, well, how would we do some advanced planning so that we wouldn't be on the day of a disaster trying to figure out what the standards of care should be or how they might change. So this is our committee membership. It's very proud to be a part of this committee. It was chaired by Dr. Larry Gostin with Georgetown University Law Center. I think many of you know him as a public health law professor. Dr. Dan Hanfling as our vice chair. And then a number of folks that really represented either state, local, government. They represented the legal piece, the ethical piece, or nursing or some other areas, and including not just public sector, but also private sector of potential response perspectives. So what are crisis standards of care? The way we defined it, and this is now from the 2009 report. By the way, let me pause. How many people have actually read the 2009 report? It was a shorter report. All right, raise them high. How many pages was it? 100. 100 pages. That's what Dr. Powell says. I never say anything against what Dr. Powell says. She's our ethicist. I want to make sure that she's happy with
it. I made that up.
She made that up. So about 100 pages. So it was a letter report. It was a very short report. How many people actually have seen the follow-up report, which is 2012? And how many pages? Yeah, it was 500-some pages, so we've got a few people. So how we define crisis standards of care is a substantial change in usual healthcare operations and the level of care is possible to deliver that's made necessary by those two conditions, those two types of disasters that we talked about, whether pervasive or catastrophic. So a substantial change in the way we do things. And that change is formally declared by a state government. And so you can't just say, it's busy ER, it's Saturday night, I just decide, okay, crisis standards of care in place, and that's it. You flip a switch, and we're talking about really something that has to be declared by a formal mechanism. And we came up with state government because we thought that there were many mechanisms and many really regulatory and other types of activities that would be happening at the state level, which I'll describe, that really would be very important for this to be at a state level and not something that would be happening in smaller swaths of land, if you will. And that this formal declaration enables specific powers and protections for healthcare providers in the necessary task of allocating and using scarce medical resources. And so this is really critical because as healthcare practitioners, many of us may be responding, but we want to know what are the limitations of our liabilities. What are going to be some of the regulatory aspects to some of the licensing changes that might be occurring in an institution or with our current or our personal or I should say our professional licenses. So this is a really important piece, and again, it really speaks to why we felt that state government was so critical. So this was, it's appropriate that this is in Dr. Hanfling's slide set because it was adapted from Dr. Hanfling's slide set. So, but the continuum of care is really, as we describe it, moving from, if you go down the blue side here and the y-axis here, conventional, contingency, and crisis. So think about conventional is where we are currently. And you may get into a point of contingency where you have a situation where now it is really busy, it may be busy for several days or what have you, and you have had to actually change the standards of care in some way or change some of your operations, but you've been able to do some other things like reallocate resources or transfer resources in from other institutions, or you might actually be able to move your patients elsewhere. But you get to this point where we call crisis continuum, crisis capacity, where at this point you now are shifting your focus. Look at that last column of focus of care, that you're not just thinking about the patient, but because the resources are so limited, you're actually thinking about the population. So we do this in public health all the time, but healthcare does not necessarily do this or think about this all the time, right? So we shift from patient focus of care to a more population perspective. So the recommendations that came out of the 2009 report, and I won't read them word for word, but I will just highlight these six recommendations that really that developing consistency was really the main thing we were looking for, that the protocols would be consistent, that they would have key elements, which we described further, that there was community and provider engagement, that we were going to ask folks to adhere to ethical norms, so you just couldn't do whatever, that it really met that you really needed to be thinking about legal protections to healthcare practitioners and institutions, ensuring consistency not just in the planning piece but really in the implementation piece, and that there was consistency within states as well as outside of states, especially when you had neighboring jurisdictions that you might be looking at cross states that might be crossing very neighboring states that might be adjoining to communities that might be impacted by a catastrophic disaster. So what happened since the 2009 report, and I'll give you like a little visual that is on the top left is H1N1. Does everybody remember H1N1? Yeah? Yes? Does anybody not remember H1N1? Okay, so it's good. I think we have a room of folks that remember 2009. And so that's actually a mass vaccination clinic that at our department that we went about with really launching some of the mass vaccination efforts in our community. And so the 2009 report really came out in a very quick, expedient manner. And what happened is that we were in this planning stage of first of all, we were waiting for, we didn't know there was this novel virus coming. You all remember novel virus, and now we need a vaccine, and then when's the vaccine going to come? And everybody wanted vaccine, and then all of a sudden you couldn't give it away, right? That was the sort of the timeline of H1N1. Well, in 2009, that's when the ASPR asked the IOM to actually release this report to really think about, well, if this were a pandemic of a severe nature, what would be those standards that we might need to think about? So why a 2012 report? Was because we didn't realize this, but when the 2009 report came out, we actually had two examples, two ways that we looked at trying to think about two different kinds of disasters. One was this pandemic, slow onset, and one was a no-notice event. And so guess what we picked? An earthquake. So an earthquake, and guess what happened in January of 2010, about 3 months after we released the report? Haiti. And so this is a picture from Haiti. I had the opportunity to respond in Haiti 12 days after the earthquake. Dr. Hanfling actually was on the ground within 48 hours after the earthquake. This is a picture of a church, and we just had this incredible church that was converted into a vaccination center, and just incredible onslaught, if you will, of people that were seeking care. So from H1N1 and a pandemic or slowly evolving event that we thought that we had gotten something out, there Haiti happened. And so what we learned later was that the federal response actually looked at even some of the recommendations of our report to really think about how they could help manage some of the Haiti-related activities and response activities. And here's an example. If those days are in the back of your mind, you'll remember that there were opportunities that you had really an overwhelming number of people that in a no-notice event that were really involved seeking care and really overwhelmed the system to the point where you had external people that were really coming in to respond. And this is a university hospital. As you can see, there was, I put it in quotes, as a hospital because it wasn't necessarily a hospital as it was really a big mass response tent that was the hospital for all intents and purposes. So the 2012 report that came out in March really set the framework and put a structure together. And I'm going to segue into the 2012 report a little bit better and a little bit more, because what this really did was to look at the 2009 report and say that what we wanted to do was to say that this is not about surge response in silo, but this is surge response as a part of a framework for catastrophic disaster response. And this is a very nice diagram that was really put forward by the committee. And does it look familiar? Does it look like something you might have seen? What's it look like?
Well, I saw the report.
Yeah, it actually, one of our committee members, Dr. Hanfling was, Dan was, I think he was outside of the Lincoln Monument, and it kind of looks like the Lincoln Monument, and I think he scribbled something on a piece of, on a napkin, and he just went ahead and put this together. But what this really articulates and really visualizes here is that you have the ethical considerations and legal authority, the groundwork, if you will, of this framework. And the steps as you move up to make sure that you're able to do this kind of planning is provider engagement, community engagement, making sure you have indicators and triggers, clinical processes and operations, and then performance improvement. So you have a way of quality assurance and really looking back at what you have done and how the response is going. At the same time, you have these cornerstones of education and information sharing. So you have this way of really working with community and providers and institutions. But the pillars are really hospital care or health care, public health, out-of-hospital care in the ambulatory setting, EMS, and emergency management and public safety. And then the capstone, if you will, local and state government and federal government as well. So this framework, I think, really helps visualize what we are talking about. This is not a siloed response. We're really talking about putting a surge framework together. And so the 2012 report, if you have a chance to look at it, and we recommend that you do, there's an introduction, and the introduction really sets the framework, as I just showed in the visual here, legal issues, cross-cutting themes with ethics, palliative care, mental health, for example. And then there are four discipline-specific volumes: state and local government, EMS, healthcare facilities, out-of-hospital care, and then really the roles of each of those stakeholders, the relevant CSC operational considerations, what are the templates that may help people in their planning activities, and then finally public engagement, and really a toolkit that was put together that I think is really a fantastic way of really thinking about how to engage the community. So we know that in the middle of a disaster response, things can get very, very big and bad and very quickly, and so things sort of spiral, if you will, from the local response to a regional jurisdictional response, to a state response, to a federal response. And so this really shows some of the emergency management functions, but also as some of the CSC guidance and the decision-making that may be in place at the bedside. And so it's really designed, if you look at the report, to really think about the system, but also to think about what's happening at the bedside as the individual practitioner who might have to make decisions and really make decisions that are going to be very challenging. So the recommendation, we had one recommendation in this report as opposed to the six recommendations previously, and the bullet, bold here, I think really captures it best. Federal, state, tribal, and local governments should develop a systems-based framework for catastrophic disaster response, which must be integrated into existing emergency response plans and programs, and to facilitate the implementation of this framework, we specifically then recommended various things, including each level of government coordinating and making sure there was consistency, that we felt that crisis standards of care should be within surge capacity and capability planning and response, and that HHS and ASPR should facilitate in at points where you have state and tribal governments within their region, but also when you have across various states, and that states should collaborate with and support local governments. And federal disaster preparedness response grants should include relevant CSC functions. And I'm going to pause right there, because as many of us know, with the hospital preparedness program, the HPP funding, the CSC, some of these surge capabilities were actually a part of the most recent iteration of the HPP guidance that came out. And most recently in the FEP guidance, the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Guidance, it's also in there. And so it really recognizes the importance of this work. And so walking it through can get complicated. And I'm supposed to say, fortunately, there's an app for that, but I don't want to talk about any particular device. So I'll just say there's a template, an app template. So it didn't really work very well, but there's a template for that. And so there are lots of templates that we have. So we have state and local templates that really talk about various tasks. Here's an example, one of the templates, EMS templates, healthcare facility templates, out-of-hospital and alternate care systems templates. And so it's really an opportunity of taking theory and bringing it to practice. And that's really a very pragmatic way that we felt that this report was going to help practitioners in the various areas that, I talked about. So with that, how am I doing on time?
It's 3:43.
Okay, so I'm going to, in about just six, seven, 8 minutes, I'm gonna go through state and local government, and I'm going to stop because I'm tired of talking, and I'm going to then introduce Dr. Powell. State and local government. So this is an important piece, and we felt, especially at APHA, that it would be important to really highlight some of the roles of government. How many folks in this room are in some way affiliated with government? Or part of government, I should say. So about half the room, maybe about 40%, 45%. So we felt that government at all levels play a crucial role in leading and coordinating CSC planning and implementation. And the interplay between state and local government was also very important. So in the 2009 report, as I mentioned, state government is ultimately accountable for what's happening within that state. But in the 2012 report, we went further and said local government is uniquely positioned in the organizational structure of states to intersect with both what's happening at that state level or the federal level, but also what's happening within a community. And so it's a kind of a very interesting perch, if you will. State and local considerations in both planning and implementation are that these emergencies, remember, they're big and bad. They're supposed to be multi-jurisdictional or statewide. They may be multi-state. We're not talking about the accident on the freeway that involves two cars and they get the people get rushed to a hospital. And maybe for a small community, that might be overwhelming. But that's not the kind of response, disaster or crisis that we're talking about. We're talking about a really big one. And that there should be state-level coordination within the state as well as outside of the state, and there should be all levels planning and response. And we also recognize that there was variation in state and local health department relationships. So we knew that the challenge of writing this report is that we knew that there were centralized structures in certain states and there were decentralized structures in other states. And so we really tried to look at a way to acknowledge that. And so the role of state government, we felt, was that it was the primary decision-making at the state government level. And further, that the state health department, we felt, was the point of contact or the place where you would really have, at the state level, what responsibilities would be related to both CSC planning but also implementation. That there was an important state and federal interplay, and that there were regional coordination, and this, I guess I showed that a little bit earlier, but RMCCs and RDMACs, et cetera. So the role of local government, on the other hand, is not a passive one, but an active one to really integrate the state efforts with local community activities and vice versa. And just as at the state level we were talking about state government and state health departments, we felt that the real response at the local level should be really at the public health agency or the local health department. And so that there were a number of things that might be happening at that local level, including coordinating with local response partners, engagement activities, et cetera. And that there is, as there was a state-federal interplay, there's a local-state interplay, and really that this requires coordination and collaboration across the board. And the reason we felt that this was important was that we wanted to make sure that there was consistency across jurisdictions. Because if you have, so I'm going to give you a Texas example. So if you have Houston saying, okay, we have crisis standard of care, we have resources that are going to be, you know, we're going to be doing things a certain way, but Austin or San Antonio, thank you, Austin and San Antonio are doing them in a different way, we really felt that you would have more opportunity for chaotic responses or inconsistent responses where you might have forum shopping where people would say, well, gee, if they're going to be, you know, more restrictive in Houston, I'm going to go to Austin or San Antonio or what have you. So we really felt like another reason why it should be at the state level. So states more actively engage in CSC planning. So those states that are really active right now, they've already done some real work so far, we say kudos, keep doing it, continue that work, but make sure you bring your local and regional partners into the mix, and to remember that local role, as I just mentioned, is a very active one. And at the implementation stage, it's really important that there is really good communication that's happening of what's happening on the ground with what's happening with the resources that might be at a state level, so that you have not just jurisdictional consistency, but you have a real good communication about on-the-ground realities. Those states that are less actively engaged, and this can also be considered when you have local health departments or local communities that have really just kind of gotten out of the, I'm not sure, I'm going to use a metaphor that I always mess up metaphors. My colleague in the back has said that to me multiple times, so I'm not going to really use a great metaphor, but the starting block, right, when you're in a race, I think it's the right one, and you take off, right? So the local health departments that are really out in front and doing things, we ask them to continue to do that, but at the same time to now bring states in if they're not already in, and to make sure that the state partners are engaged, because guess what? At the planning stage, you might be able to get away with really having locals or regional entities doing things, but when you're at the implementation stage, when you finally have a crisis standards, a crisis situation that requires crisis standards of care, you really are going to need state-level involvement. So we want to make sure that happens as early as possible. And so this is a little visual that just talks a little bit about jurisdictional consistency and kind of walking through conventional contingency into crisis, and really just says that we recognize that there is some level of local variation, but that happens even now and in a conventional situation. But our hope is that as you have this in advance planning, so you're not doing it on the fly, that there would be a better use of resources so that the consistency is going to allow for resources to be best allocated within a state system. We know the state's response can be very, very big again. It can spiral very quickly, so from conventional contingency to crisis. And again, we have templates that are to help in the both development stage and planning stage, as well as in the implementation stage. And here's an example of that. And I guess I am done. I've got 3 minutes to spare. Not bad. So here is my contact information, and this is how you can actually download the report and.